Okay, so quick intro. I work for the BBC. I'm VP of Digital Content. I'm based in Hollywood. But I also work for the BBC in London, so I'm half public service, half commercial. We do a couple of games, and I blog about games at wonderlandblog.com and Kotaku, so I'm going to be kind of hosting this. What I'm going to do is introduce these guys to you, and then they will have a couple of minutes to just sort of talk about what they do, maybe ask you guys some questions. Then I've got a couple of questions to kind of set the framework, and then we're going to open it up to you for at least half of the session. So please use the microphone, come forward, ask questions, you know, whatever you want to ask. It doesn't matter if you don't know what on earth an ARG is or whether you've played five of them, come forward, because we want this to be completely interactive. So, right, in order, Brian Clark, founder of GMD Studios, known for probably, I think, Art of the Heist, would you say?
For Audi.
For Audi. So that was a large ARG that came out a year and a half.
Two years ago.
Yeah. Brian also founded IndieWire, which I'll let him explain more about, but he has a film background. To Brian's left is Evan Jones. Evan is award-winning and probably best known for a show in Canada called Regenesis that had a large ARG attached to it. He's now founded a company called Stitch. To his left, Brooke, who is a consultant and a game designer. Brooke is very involved in the community of ARGs, and obviously ARGs are really all about the community, so she's very involved with the player end of things. And to her left is Dan. Dan Hahn, Chief Creative Officer, Evangelist.
Yeah.
For Mind Candy, who produced and made Perplex City, which I'm sure you've all heard of. So I'll let these guys just have a little bit of a chat with you for a couple of minutes, and then I'll kick off with some questions. So go ahead. I know you had a question, Brian.
Well, yeah. I mean, I just kind of want to get a feel for who all is here in the audience. So, like, how many of you would consider yourselves storytellers or writers?
Yeah, let's have a show of hands.
How many of you consider yourselves, like, bloggers or journalists or...
All on the edge.
Can someone shout out, like, if you didn't raise your hand, what you are? Entertainment company? You think, oh, okay.
Who here has played an ARG?
Cool.
Who here is hoping someone will define that phrase before we get too far? There we go.
Right.
Okay, good. So we got a little mix of everything. So GMD Studios, we started as, my partners and I are all from entertainment industry. We started in 94. We're an experimental media firm, so we're always looking for how new media lets us do the things from traditional media in new ways. So sometimes that looks like a publisher, and that we publish IndieWire that's been an online, self-sustaining, no venture capital content venture for 11 years. And then we do things where we take that knowledge and leverage it for advertisers. So a lot of the alternate reality gaming that we've done have been with ad agencies for big sponsors like More to See for Sharp and Art of the Heist for Audi and Who is Benjamin Stowe for GM. So we're kind of treating this as an opportunity online. Those of you who blog or publish online know that you've got a very different relationship with your audience. You know, there's not a theoretical relationship between the writer and the author. There's a very real relationship that gives you lots of feedback. So for us, ARGing is an interesting opportunity to use that feedback and change the story and the product in real time based upon what the audience is telling you they like or don't like. So when I talk about it, you'll hear me talk a lot about story structure, but also about how you could measure it for a marketer and show some like real brand value and thus fund your art through sponsorship.
I'm going to be taking sort of a different angle, basing it on some of my previous experience working as creative director at Xenophile Media. And that's where I've been for the past 3 years, where I've been working with television production companies to enhance their creative, original creative, into interactivity in the form of alternate reality games, and how that works in a cross-media way, dealing with something that is perhaps already produced, like a television series, and how the fluid nature of the interactive can change to adjust to match that initial creative.
Okay, and as she said, I come to this with a strong community background. I actually got into alternate reality games from sociology undergrad, where I was looking at online communities and how they can sort of transform the world, you know, that idealistic thing that we all thought in 1995, and to a degree even still do. So for the past 5 years, I've been building or working with the community sites, Unfiction and ARGN or ARGNET, and now I'm taking it into a more serious games segment where serious games, I mean, that sounds really boring, but it's basically, in a way, games for change or games that don't do or do something other than just purely entertain. So you can harness the community aspect of alternate reality games to do some really neat things. And that's where I'll probably spend some of my time talking about.
So, hi, I'm Dan. I work for a company called Mind Candy. We're VC-backed. We've been around for about 2.5 years. So we're relative newcomers on this scene, and our main product is something called Perplexity. What Mind Candy's really about is, or at least it was in our first season, was about treasure, puzzles, and story. So on the treasure side, what we did is we kicked off a worldwide treasure hunt. We buried an object called the Ricada Cube somewhere on the world, and then we gave a £100,000 prize to the winner, $200,000. And that was claimed about 3 weeks ago. We're really into puzzles. That's how we interact with our audience a lot of the time. So we do everything from heat-sensitive ink on cards to getting people to decipher microdots, getting them to learn about hieroglyphics and decipher lots of interesting codes. We get our players to engage in social engineering and try and get their way past things like security guards that we play. And on the kind of more extreme side, our players end up doing things like writing distributed RC5 decryption clients. So that's the kind of puzzle stuff that we do. And we're really big on story. We're really big on narrative. So what we've been doing for the last 2.5 years, more or less, is plotting a story that spans lots of different media. It's got backstabbings. It's basically you're pretty much a traditional soap opera. You've got murders, babies, betrayal, affairs. There's a really great audience out there for that kind of thing. And the interesting thing that we found there is that there's a great audience split around 50-50 male-female. So what I do at Mind Candy is my official title is Chief Operating Officer. We're very much in startup mode, so I do a bit of everything. So I, you know, help out with legal, payroll, and all kind of stuff like that. But my personal background, I first came into ARGs in 2001 with The Beast, which was a production by Microsoft. And I got very involved in the community there. I subsequently worked with Microsoft for one of their internal SQL projects for that. And then I came into Mind Candy. So I spend a lot of time now evangelizing ARGs to the outside community.
Great. Okay, that should have, I hope, give you a little bit of a framework. I mean, ARGs are probably, what, 5 years old? Five-ish?
Yeah.
So they haven't been around forever. They did pretty much come out, I think, of the gaming community, probably from a bit of a marketing and promotions angle.
I think it's kind of interesting because I think it kind of got almost invented by a few different communities all at once.
At the same time,
which is always, you talk about
emergent
film people, and you can kind of see them do the same thing with narrative.
We've mentioned cross-media, and of course, I think the defining thing about ARGs is they do usually take pieces of whatever it is that they're doing from film, television, radio, magazines, print, the internet, weave them together into a story that players play through. And they can last for any... I mean, Perplexity has been running... That season one ran for...
Season one ran for about 2 years.
Those others run for mere 3 months, right?
Yeah.
So there's no standard length.
A mere 3 months.
a mere 3 months, yeah. Anyway, I want to start off, so hopefully you now have a clear idea of what an ARG kind of is, although we'll go into some examples. But I want to ask you guys, because it did really, I think, start out of marketing as well as the gaming industry, but as you said, popped up all at once. What are ARGs really for? What would you say they're really for? Are they promotional? What are they?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think for most of us sitting up here, the genre is so new that it's kind of like asking what are books for, or what are websites for, mm-hmm. or what's a newspaper for.
Right.
I think what we're experimenting with is using lots of different kind of media and then using them together to create a new platform to tell stories. So working out a way to use text messages, phone calls, faxes, live events, blogs, all that kind of stuff, you know, instant messaging, video, online video, and using that weaving that together to create a more kind of coherent experience than you'd experience with just one of those media.
Why do you think marketing folks, so for instance, after the heist was Audi, and the Lost experience is another well-known one, which is obviously entirely designed to promote Lost, the TV show. Why do you think marketers have picked up on this? Because you would think that creating another story is quite a lot of work to do in ARG.
Yeah.
Obviously much more work than just sticking an advert up. So
but
what are the reasons?
Conversely, you've got a couple of factors involved. One is that in the U.S. especially, you've got a big shift of budget away from broadcast, away from print and traditional media, into things that are viewed as more interactive. But that raises new questions, right? Because advertisers have typically been interested in reach. How many millions of people will see this? And now they're starting to realize that the quality of the engagement and the quality of that interaction with the brand have a lot more impact than just the sheer number of people you reach. So where a television advert might, in the best case scenario, give you 30 seconds of attention, an ARG will produce session lengths that are 30 minutes or longer and heavy repeat visitation for all the same reasons that people tune into an episodic television series.
Right.
But it's still measurable, right? That's the beautiful thing about the web, is if you were trying to do this, say, as live theater, you'd be really stuck up against the fact that you don't have any framework for measuring whatsoever. Where here, you can both sort of measure the way you would web and also the way you would measure PR. Because a lot of this happens on sites that you don't even control. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, a lot of gameplay and discussion happens in community sites like Unfiction. So there you have a community that isn't really under your control, isn't in your weblogs, but is definitely engaged in the work that you're doing and feeding that to other people. So that aspect of it makes it more immediately provable as an ROI medium for marketers,
right,
but a little more difficult, I think, for a fan-based model, because outside of Majestic, which was a very early game, about the same time as I Love Bees,
yeah,
there really hasn't been a successful attempt at charging subscribers. So you don't have book sales or ticket sales the way you would in a normal sort of storytelling environment.
I think also there's a trend or there's a term that's coming out now called something called continuous partial attention that Linda Stone's talking about. And it's something that a lot of people, I mean, I've done it
Linda
before.
Linda Stone is Microsoft, Google?
Yeah.
Microsoft.
Yeah. And
if you Google Linda Stone continuous partial attention, you find out this. She does long talks on this.
She basically talks about what pretty much a lot of people in this room are doing right now. So you're all here, you're all listening to us doing this panel, but at the same time, there are lots of people blogging, there's lots of people checking email at the same time. So a lot of people are paying continuous partial attention to lots of things at the same time. So you see this with TV, you see this with audience fragmentation, you see this with people watching TV shows, listening to the radio at the same time, they're in IM, they're also browsing the web. What ARGs offer is the potential to reach the people who you would only reach once, say through a TV advert, but do it across a number of different media in a coherent way.
Well, it's really interesting. Yeah.
I think just to follow up on that, Dan, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking was that these alternate reality games really seem like they are sort of taking advantage of the natural state of the internet, which
right.
is that people are always hunting for little bits of information and assembling them into some kind of knowledge. You know, you're graduating from that data to knowledge stage. And the way that these are created is the way that we seem to be interacting with the world now, is that these different sources of media are all happening at once, and I think that's a good way of saying it.
Yeah, we did some research at the BBC quite recently, which showed that, in fact, 50%, this is in the UK, but I'm sure it's pretty similar in the States, 50% of television watching is now just, in fact, the TV on in the background, which is up from, I think, around 10% in the 50s. So you're right about spreading across media. But who would you say really plays? I'm going to go to you here, Brooke, on this because for the people. So from what we've been talking about so far, it sounds like we're talking about people who carry laptops all the time or have multiple devices. Are we talking about just those people, or do you think it's a broader picture?
And it's a much broader picture, but there's definitely, you have to be computer literate for most alternate reality games. It's not that it has to be that way. That's just how it is, because there are pieces from all over the place. So you have to have a functional understanding of how to get and find information online, which actually is one reason why it makes them such good corporate training tools, because it teaches that functionality. But the audience, you know, as far as games go, people love alternate reality games because it has a huge number of women involved, both in the playing and in the development process. Age, you know, it's hard to say because there's games like Jamie Cain from the BBC, which are actively targeting teenage girls.
Yep.
And then there's games that are much more cerebral that seem to attract the 30-year-olds, that you know, the late 20s. Mm. Perplexed City seems to attract like late teens to mid 20s.
I think. I mean, our age range peaks at around 26, and for us, it's interesting because the way that we structured our first season, there were so many different facets to it. So we had the audience that we had who were following the strict ARG, the story side, was very different from the people who were playing the other side of our business, which was the puzzle side, the straight puzzle card side.
What breakdown would that be?
It's hard to say. What we do know is that there was a much higher proportion of women who were following the story than we would have expected otherwise. Uh-huh. And that for the strict casual game side, for the strict puzzle card solving side, we had a very large age skew. So we were going from like 10 years old up to about 80. So that was very much the casual gaming market.
Yeah.
As opposed to at the moment, the kind of traditional audience that we see for an ARG, which is slightly more hardcore.
You can really customize an audience because you're doing this with story. You can write something.
It's like saying who watches television, right? It's very different for different shows, and you can write stories designed to appeal to particular audiences. But I think, you know, the phenomenon of having a lot of women as players and developers in the community comes from the fact that most ARG models aren't competitive gaming, they're collaborative gaming. Mm. So the whole audience is solving things together. And I think that that's one of the things that makes it appeal more to women than, say, a first-person shooter or something that was much more sort of adrenaline junky, competitive.
Yeah, it's got a whole social quality as well that's a big draw, and the amount of interaction that goes on between players, but also the feeling that you get of being one of those characters in the story as it goes along is that it really feels like an empowering thing that I think hits a certain niche that it may not with others.
Yeah, I mean, story's interesting. I just want to dive in here, but because I'd like to be corrected on this, but I did hear a rumor that 97%, and this is why I'm kind of 97% of fan fiction, this may be in the sci-fi community only, but 97% of fan fiction is written by women. Is that true? Has anybody heard this before?
Yeah. I would not be surprised.
Although I also have to say, just to be difficult, that story does obviously appeal to women, but first-person shooters, I used to play Quake for England, so
we're
head.
Talking in generalities, specifics.
No. I'm always obliged. Right, let's move on with where do you see ARGs going? Because we're talking about really broad spectrum here, so it's kind of difficult to. We keep dealing with generalizations, but if you can, in general, where do you see ARGs going from here?
I could bring up a couple of things. Just, you know, last weekend was the Alternate Reality Gaming Festival in San Francisco. So a lot of that community sort of gathered together to talk about stuff like that. And among the people they had as panelists were the filmmakers behind The Lonely Girl. In part because initially the ARG audience mistook Lonely Girl for being an alternate reality game. And then when they discovered it wasn't an alternate reality game, they launched one. The fans did. And the creators went, wow, that's pretty cool. We'll let you be the official Lonely Girl alternate reality game. So you get this sort of ability, I think, for that, the idea of alternate reality gaming as a framework by which storytellers and audiences can play together instead of playing in just a one-way direction.
Yeah,
I think one of the things that's moving forward is the talk, and I've heard a lot of talk about making it into a more mainstream experience. Mm. I am interested to see all the different models that take it in that direction. I think there may be certain games that are played at a hardcore level and certain ones that are played at a mainstream level, or ones that separate the community into different levels of play and all sorts of different models that will allow people who, I mean, there are different like stories of people who spend hours and hours being involved in these, but I do think that there is an audience who wants to be engaged in a story on a much briefer level.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we're definitely going to see alternate reality games spreading more into television. are taking from television, the whole interactive, like Heroes, the 360 experience, the Lost experience. They love to call things the experience. So the television experience will be a big one. But I also think that there's a lot of awareness for how games can do good things. And right. So we're definitely going to be seeing how games can help people work, how they can help people find places in their cities, how they can, you know, interact with their world in a different way. And so I think alternate reality games tend to lead to that in a definitely. Natural progression. So I think we're going to see it spread out.
And you should have seen at GDC, at the Game Developers Convention, academia is interested in this because they're looking at this as a teaching mechanism. The not-for-profit world is looking at this as a way to affect social change by large groups. Educators are looking at this. Marketers are looking at this. Storytellers are looking at this. So in a way, I think the number of people actually kind of in the scene is greatly dwarfed by the number of people like watching the scene and trying to figure out where this can go next. So we're definitely in a like infancy phase in terms of what other people in these other communities as they grab this model and twist it into something else.
Definitely. I mean, one of the things that we've learned from Perplex City is that it's terribly hard to get into a game that's 2 years long and then you're about a year and a half in. It's pretty much impossible. So we've been looking at lots of other media. We've been looking at television. Because that's a very easy comparison to make. We like to say, well, you know, what is it that Lost... Well, maybe Lost isn't such a good example, but what is it that 24 does? What do television shows do to help you catch up halfway through a season or three-quarters of the way through a season? So I think we're going to see a shift, and this is something that we're going to be trying out, towards much more episodic-based gaming. I mean, there's a shift towards that in the gaming industry in general, what with Half-Life.
Yeah.
So we're going to see it.
So there'll be a shift towards episodic gaming. Gaming will happen in more, or will probably happen in more bite-size chunks to make it more accessible to people, instead of having an episode or having an episode, an instance of gameplay where you don't know how long it's going to last. I think what we'll see is probably companies coming out and saying, you know, this is probably going to only last 2 to 6 weeks. So you know it's not going to completely take over your life.
So it has a start date and an end date, like a television series does.
It has an end date. Mm-hmm. You know that you can come in, you can just catch up, you can just play this episode, mm-hmm. and then that's all that you have to do. You can just dip into it.
That's been an issue that I've been bringing up, is that with well-established media, like, for instance, books, they have this really sort of tactile way of giving you the information of, this is going to be this long,
yeah.
you know, or that long, or something. And at the moment, we're still working on that. Is when you get involved in a rabbit hole, you don't really know where you're going.
What you're signing up for.
Yeah, that's got an excitement level to it, but it also has a really practical issue, which is, you know, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm committing to.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see, what else have we got? Why do you think... For somebody who wants to make ARG, so we've been talking about the audience, and if you involve, anybody who's run a website will know that if you involve the audience, it's a lot of work. Immediately, the amount of effort goes up, and therefore costs go up. So we really are talking about playing with the audience here. You have an audience for an ARG, and you're using them, you're getting them involved, etc. But that's presumably costs. So,
to some extent, but realize, I think most of that cost is creative personnel. So right. that's why you have a really vibrant grassroots community in alternate reality gaming as well, is that most of the things that you would spend money on, you could replace with elbow grease. Mm. Now, obviously, if you've got a 100,000-pound prize or helicopters yeah. coming out of the sky or cars being stolen, just like any movie, you know, there's small-budget movies and big-budget movies. But teams that are willing to put their energy in can bypass a lot of the things that marketers or companies would have to spend money on.
Yeah, I worked on a game that, you know, of course I'm going to say this, I think it had a really high production value. It was a fan fiction game for the Matrix universe. And we attracted over 100,000, 125,000 players, over 50,000 players that actually made it like three stages into the game. And there was, you know, as long as, I mean, it was...
And what was your budget?
And how big was the team?
The budget was under $10,000. And the team, we had seven people, four of us that were pretty much full-time. The other three were sort of content writers. You know, oh no, I need this like massive article on something. Can you write it in 3 minutes? Sure.
I think that really highlights one of the things that we're all grappling with is the content problem.
Yeah.
Because with this kind of audience, you create an incredibly passionate, incredibly inquisitive audience, and it's content creation. It's the creative that really sucks up time and resource. Mm.
At ArgFest, your brother called it just-in-time content creation, which I thought was a wonderfully nice way to describe the feeling of chaos and terror that actually accompanies.
It's fear, it's panic, it's, you know, it's writing copy at 3 a.m, you know, that really should have been up about 15 minutes ago. But the great thing about that is that it shows the interactivity. This is really user-centered, player-centered design.
Mm.
We watch what the players are doing all the time. I'm like, this is what you guys did with Metacortex and with all the other arcs. It's you watch what the players are doing, you watch what they like, you watch what doesn't work and what works, and then you constantly are adapting to it.
Or to be more specific, like as a story writer, every ARG that we've done, we've ended up rewriting it significantly halfway after it went public. Often because the audience comes up with better writing than we came up with. You know, they start thinking, oh, that guy's going to turn on us. And you think, wow, that's a good idea to let that guy turn on him. You get everyone in a room and you start going, okay, well, what if that guy wasn't the villain? What if this guy was the villain? How would we change the story from here on out? And that's something you don't get except like maybe in the editing room on a film where you've already shot everything and you're trying to piece the story together. But here you have a chance to let the audience really tell you what they want to see next.
Yeah, it is really apparent when you have, along the design process, that you have the players not just in mind, but in notes in front of you that say, this is what they're thinking right now. And it does influence all of your future decisions. I think, to answer your question as well, is that there is still an issue right now of an appreciation of the level of content and the creative that goes into some of these projects and how they are very different than putting a website up.
Right.
And sometimes, I mean, it's about working with partners bringing them along to sort of appreciate the kind of production that goes into these behind the scenes that they also involve. You know, they're not just static pages. They're constantly being updated.
I'm going to ask one last question, then we're going to open up to you guys. When does this go horribly wrong?
Every time, every ARG. There's at least one good case. You know, like my favorite one from Art of the Heist was, you know, we sent a bunch of people to go break into an Audi backstage at a party at Coachella to steal an SD card from the drive mechanism that contained puzzles about an art heist being planned in Italy. And the company dropped off the vehicle with the correct serial number because all of this required that the correct serial number for the vehicle be matched up to things, but then forgot to unlock the car and left Coachella. So we had people show up and unable to get into that car, and so they took pictures of themselves with a sign saying, "We were here, where were you?" and posted that.
But they didn't wreck the car.
But, you know, those kinds of things, you know, because of the chaos of doing things in real world and with production elements that you don't have, like, established guidelines for the right way to deal with people pretending to be secret agents at a music festival and breaking into cars, you always have to try to figure out how you recover from that because you don't have a chance to say, okay, time out, let's do it over again. Mm-hmm. Right? Let's come back tomorrow, let's do it again. Instead, you have to just take that as reality and adapt it from there. But I think every ARG has at least one horror story like that, right?
At least.
Yes. I think also some of the other things to bring up is that it's a very careful line that you have to walk in order not to be put in the box of being a hoax.
Right.
And there's a lot of times that I've seen people who come at it as a hoax and say, I'm going to create an alternate reality game that is going to be a complete hoax. And that feeling from the audience really changes the way that the gameplay works, is that, you know, exposing yourself through to a very committed audience really, you know, it almost is a betrayal of the gameplay
experience.
So they
don't like that.
Well, it depends. Sometimes it works, but I am more of the mindset that it's a dangerous territory to walk through. And on that note, I mean, there's also, I mean, you talk about horribly wrong, and I'm going to diverge a little bit, but I mean, there's lots of writing about things like psyops and things where, you know, creating fiction borders very closely on propaganda. I mean, the idea of doing this for entertainment is all well and good, but it also does exist in other ways that are much more serious.
Right.
Well, and that was one of the biggest fears, or not biggest fears, but it came up a lot 5 years ago, and it's lessened, but, you know, every once in a while you hear that Ender's Game scenario.
Yeah.
Like, are you just creating Ender's Game? And, you know, you could take it that way, especially if you go towards the hoax, but... And perhaps it's an ethical thing, but you have to make sure that players know that there is a game to be played. Because if there's not, why do you want to play it? You know, so it doesn't.
And that they can trust you, because right. They're going to do things that they shouldn't do.
Yeah.
They shouldn't just listen to random people on the internet and go steal stuff from cars at a music festival, right?
Yeah.
But despite their mother's advice, they're going and doing that because they have an assumption that they're not really going to get hurt.
Yeah.
And that's really important for you as a storyteller to make sure you don't betray.
Yeah, so, you know, when the hoax thing comes up, I mean, that is when an arc goes wrong.
I think, I mean, there's some practicalities involved as well. So there's a really fine line to be trodden in terms of when that goes wrong. Then you can get some seriously bad PR very quickly. These are, and I'll say it again, these are very connected, very passionate people. And it will be around the blogosphere like that if you put one foot wrong. To balance that, they have, you know, when it's going right, it goes incredibly well. You get all of the buzz, you get all of the passion, you get, you know, mashups that you would never dream of coming into existence, and all that stuff. So it's really, I mean, we had some fun stuff happen when we were dealing with our PR company, and they were trying to sort out our PR for when our treasure got found, and they're saying, so, you know, this is all lined up. We've got a TV interview for Friday morning, and we're saying, yeah, well. We don't know when it's going to be found. What do you mean you don't know when it's going to be found? Well, you see, it's a treasure hunt. We're not there watching it. If we were, then they'd probably give away where it was.
Right.
So, yeah, it was something that was really hard for the PR company to get their heads around. There are other considerations as well. So I have conversations with our public liability insurance people.
Right.
Because we do lots of live events. We, you know, we have black helicopters buzzing people. We have, you know, we ask people to do some really strange things that we hope, well, that we know are safe. But, again, these are very committed people, and they may
well
do. You
don't know where it's going to go. Yeah, I saw people doing a conga around Trafalgar Square thanks to this man. And how many people did you stuff into a phone box?
Oh, probably an illegal number.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think a lot of it has got to come from an awareness that for these to work really well, you have to give up an element of control. And that's where it can get risky. That's where the bad things can start to happen.
But that's where the fun happens.
It's also when the fun happens. You know, it's a great thrill. And that's where I think you can really show your community how much they mean to you. And that is worth so much.
It's pretty obvious you guys really love your jobs. It does sound like a fun thing to do. All right, questions? There's a microphone. If you want to maybe just come up and form a queue, that would be great. Sorry to make you move.
Fabulous.
Uh-oh.
This is good.
Hello, Brian.
How you doing, Steve?
Good. In terms of user engagement and the passionate, you know, type of user experience that you're generating and all the... an enormous amount of content that people are generating, the brand ambassadors that people are going to go out and, like, in terms of a commercially applied arc, okay, awesome. Can see why a corporate client would want to buy that. On the other side of that, when things go horribly wrong, the fact that it is a discipline that's in its infancy. Is it a discipline? I don't know, you know. And so... if any of you are familiar with how creative gets pushed through the sausage factory with a major automotive client.
Oh, yeah.
And the brand manager, I met the brand manager for Audi at Driving Interactive, you know, several months ago, and I'm like, this guy was, like, incredibly forward-thinking. You could tell he was going to advocate for some kind of radical, you know, new program for Audi. Audi has the brand equity. They can afford to do that. But how do you sell something that... you know, in order to get those high production values that are going to engage people, there's that log curve in terms of the labor intensity that you have to invest in the project. You don't know how many people you're going to get involved.
Right.
It could totally go to shit.
But you can still plan that. I mean, just from a media end. I mean, the portion of the budget you put into media lets you predict what your reach is going to be. Then the real quality is, like, can I engage that audience and keep them? And I think the way we do it with ad agencies is really, you know, if you can't afford to experiment with 1% of your marketing budget,
right,
you're going to always fall behind. And the brands that tend to be most interested in experimenting are the brands that are in pain. Because the brands that are doing really well, they just keep doing what they're doing. But as soon as they become the number three or the number four player in their space, they start saying, what do I do that my competitor's not doing? Mm-hmm. And that's where you just try to keep it to, you know, not an amount of money where they're going to say, God, that's that there goes Audi. Right? But instead, a small enough amount that it's more like what the production side of a traditional ad spend would be rather than what the media spend portion of it would look like.
I have to be I should probably be honest here and say that that's not yet a problem that we have necessarily had to experience. Now, just addressing your point on what happens when, you know, when this gets pushed through the sausage factory. When The Beast was produced at Microsoft, it was effectively a dark project. No one knew about it. Legal did not know about it. And this is Microsoft, right? There is no way that project would have gotten out the door if people knew about it. From Mindcandy's perspective, at the moment, our phone is ringing off the hook in terms of people coming to us and saying, what you're doing is amazing. We want one of those, please. So, but at the same time, there is an entirely different set of companies and brands out there who we are going to, and they're saying, okay, well, that does sound interesting, but, you know, this is going to take quite a while for us to get our head around. So I'd say that there's a sizable audience of companies and brands out there who get this, which is great from our point of view. But then, yeah, there is a long, hard sell for a lot of the others.
Good answer. That was mine.
I have a question about ARGs and sort of public safety. Looking ahead, you know, are ARGs sort of the bridge between the living room and the street, taking video games from the living room, moving them into the street? When I look at lifestyle invading ARGs like Street Wars, or you know, even one step beyond, the mixed reality games being developed by, in the UK, Blast Theory.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these are first-person shooters, MMOs, you know, being, you know, taking place in the physical world. And it seems like, you know, looking ahead, there's going to be some fool who takes, you know, GTA or Manhunt or Gone Postal and develops an ARG around that. And I don't know if you guys can kind of speak to
Manhunt, the ARG. Oh, my God.
Wow. Yeah, this is closer to your stuff, Evan. You know, you've been,
oh, is
you're,
it? Well, Manhunt?
You've certainly done stuff that could be mistaken.
Well, yeah, we did had a bioterrorist attack in the first episode of the series. And so we always found it most useful to add an extra layer, which said, before we go into the real fiction, we're going to just take a moment and say to ourselves that we are about to step over that line and say, this is all for play and fake, and isn't that nice? Okay, now that you've realized that, here we go. And we're gonna walk into this door. That has been always the way that we point people back to say, look, it's really not our responsibility if people take things that they have acknowledged as fictional and believe it. You know, there are miles of that in every media.
They have their own problems.
Right.
and so I think that that's the important thing that I would point to, is that I think it's a responsibility to go there and to say that it's false before you go in and to say that it's real.
We'll know that the arguing genre has matured when someone starts saying, I did it because of an arg.
Yeah.
Because they've said it about books, they've said it about movies, they've said it about video games.
Yeah.
People are always looking for those influencer blames. So
we're
I think
good.
The only reason why we haven't heard that from someone yet is because it's still a scene. It hasn't grown big enough that a serial killer has become an ARG fan. But
we've not been on Fox News yet.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That seems full focus on family wants to go after us or something like that.
My name is Brian. I work for Greenpeace International, and I'm interested to hear more about games that matter and interact with the real world in a real way, simply because we've had some very good experience with traditional game formats on our website that are built for sometimes for activist purpose, more often for educational purposes, awful lot of traffic. But I dream of the interactive platform that's going to do something about climate change and get that particular demographic of young women, 26-year-old people out there doing something for that. And so what's the sort of shoestring budget development possibilities for this? Great, you can develop one for $10,000. What does it take to get that out and, you know, totally viral and going wild?
I think he likes you.
Yeah. I think he does.
You just set me up really nicely there. Keep your eye out in the next couple weeks for something on climate change, perhaps, maybe. I don't know anything, of course. But, you know, there was a really interesting keynote at GDC by Jay McGonigal, who's doing amazing work in this field. And she brought up, I don't know how many of you heard about Last Call Poker. It was sort of an unknown alternate reality game, surprisingly. I thought it was fantastic. But they sent people out into cemeteries
to play poker
with the tombstones. Now,
historical famous cemeteries where, like, noted cowboys were buried.
And the whole thing was, I mean, it really fit in the story game, and it never once occurred to me while I was playing this game that, you know, they were getting me to a cemetery because, hey, cemeteries need live bodies because they're losing their land to big box stores, to condos. The land is too valuable to just have it sitting there with, you know, 200-year-old dead people. So by bringing in bodies, they were able to show that it had value as a public space. And so cemeteries could then point to that. So that's an example from the past of what alternate reality games.
But just to add one more thing, they knew this. They talked to all of these parks and recreation departments to try to find out how this marketing campaign could also help solve that need. And so they built in game mechanics like you would get extra points if you cleaned up the graveyard. So these groups that would come and play didn't come and destroy these places. They actually left them better than when they first arrived at.
And it was a game for Activision's gun. I mean, it wasn't a promotion for cemeteries. It was a promotion for a first-person shooter. But, you know, there's also Jane has a game that she's working with another guy, Ken Eklund, that's called World Without Oil. And it's going to get people to imagine what life would be like if there is no oil. How do you date if you can't get in your car to go someplace?
How do you have a wedding if your family can't fly from all over the country to attend it?
And it's going to get people, get you, hopefully you'll all play, get you guys to go and talk about these things and to explore this. And while at the end of that game, not only are you going to have fun, you know, thinking about these theoretical ideas, but at the end there's going to be this massive database of things that people did fictionally that might be able to prepare us for when that time comes, if it does come. So there's a lot of, you know, really exciting things that can be done with these games that can engage us on a level other than, you know...
Yeah, so it's harnessing ideas.
I think it's about putting a spotlight and a human face on the issues. And so by basing a storyline around an issue that you feel passionate about, it does exactly what all the other media does, is draw attention to it.
So I mean, just to draw on what Evan said, I mean, this really shows the power of story and the power of narrative. Mm-hmm. The things that you can get people to do when they are totally immersed in a story are amazing. I mean, one of the best examples is so you take a storyline in ARG. It's happened so many times. You take a character, you put them in peril, and then you have a social engineering type puzzle where, for the players to save this character, who they've known in our case for say 2 years, they've watched this character grow for 2 years. It's been like a soap opera to them, and this person's going to die if collectively as players you can't get the security guard to let you in to this building. So then, I mean, just think of the possibilities. People look this guy up in the blog that you've created for him. They find out they've got kids. So some people might take the strategy of saying, right, we're going to kidnap your kids if you don't let our character in. Some people
that's
will
a great
out.
Idea for Greenpeace, right?
Yeah.
No.
So I mean, this shows the power of narrative to get people to, as a call to action, really, to get people to do things that they otherwise wouldn't normally do because they're suddenly identifying with a character that they really care about.
We've just got to avoid the edutainment trap, right? Because there's certainly a perception that games that are serious aren't fun. When in reality, if we can find a way to let those two things coexist.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I thought the you guys mentioning that people thought Lonely Girl 15 was an ARG was pretty interesting, and because like for me that was all about like figuring out where this is coming from, like is this evil, like who's behind this, yeah. What's going on, and I feel like to me anyway I'm all new to this, but like that seems to be a sort of core fundamental principle of these games where it's just like being in on something that others aren't necessarily in this public space. And how do you, like, first, do you guys think that that is a core part of these games? And also, how do you see that, like, coexisting as they become more promotional, which it seems to be?
I think that's one motivation. I mean, the whole, you know, I know something you don't know is a really exciting thing.
That's a viral thing, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not just for ARGs. I think it applies to pretty much everything. It's you know, being the first person to know about something.
Yeah,
but really, conversely, what we're doing is we're trying to give the audience something to do rather than just read. And the simplest thing you can do is take your narrative and break it into 1,000 pieces and hide them all over the place, right? Because then the audience has to become this, like, active researcher. So it's like CSI. It's forensic storytelling, right, where the audience is actually assembling that and thus feels ownership over it. So part of that is, yeah, I know something you don't know, but it's also I know something you don't know, and now I'm going to share it with you, right? Rather than I know something you don't know, I'm going to keep
it. It's very collaborative, isn't it?
The feeling of finding something out and then being able to bring it to the rest of the community and show it off is a major driver for this type of gameplay.
Yeah. I mean, with Perplexity, even though there was a massive amount of money to be won, which you would think would make people keep the bits that they'd uncovered secret, in fact, it was the opposite, wasn't it? Every time they uncovered something, they'd rush to the forums and go, "Yeah."
People were very realistic and they were very open. I mean, we did see some closing up, and there was kind of like, okay, we think they're in kind of the right area now. But they were still sharing information in ways that we didn't think they would. I think part of the question is also kind of goes back to the one of the very first things we talked about on this panel is that the question about whether this is real or not, or kind of discovering something and kind of trying to work out where it's coming from and what it's for. I think that's just something that we're seeing at the beginning of this, because again, it's like asking that question about a book. As media or television as media. It's like, do I know if this TV show is true or not? And I think we're going to start evolving into this is entertainment, right? I know, and most people who are playing, I would think everyone who's playing an alternate reality game knows that it's a game, but they're just trying to figure out the stuff about it. So I guess it can be a little like Memoirs of a Geisha, where, you know, you have plot twists at the end. I don't want to give any spoilers or anything, but... But that kind of thing, where I mean, it's fiction. It's a way of telling a story, and you know, it's all about the narrative. It's all about engaging people with that and wanting people to be brought along with it.
I guess sort of the other part was, how does that coexist with the promotional nature of these?
But it is. That's exactly it. Like, just as an example, real quick, who is Benjamin Stove? It was a 3-week ARG about ethanol use, and we didn't mention the name of the sponsor until the third day from the end. And so consequently, the community the whole time was saying, this is obviously a big game. Who's the sponsor? And they thought it was a rum company. They thought it was totally making this stuff up. But then when we gave them that information, they propagated it, right?
So because
it was the solution of a mystery. Right, they expected
a sponsor. They didn't have a problem with the fact that it was a sponsor.
How can we be doing this? Oh, no, they expect a sponsor. And in fact, they were sort of surprised that they weren't being told who the sponsor was. They were expecting like an overt brand.
So you made it part of the game.
That's
quite telling, because right now, the audience expects ARGs to have sponsors.
Right.
It expects them to be tied into a brand. It's very rare, and Perplexity and Kathy's book, which is something that 42 are doing, are pretty much the only ones right now that aren't tied to a brand and aren't a promotional exercise. In Perplexity's case, it's interesting because Perplexity is, in effect, promoting itself. We have the rest of the brand that we are, in effect, marketing with the ARG.
Everybody understands you had an alternative form of revenue, so you sell the puzzle cards and then the ARG comes with that, whereas most of the ARGs are free, but at that point there's a sponsor. So there's just a general understanding that that's okay and expected.
Cool. Hi. I come from sort of the non-idealistic spectrum. I work for a major media company, and we kind of have the opposite problem of people getting it. It's not that they saw the lost experience, some of our people, and went, came to, I work in the interactive department, and they said, we want that for one of our shows. And I told them, well, I don't know that that's really appropriate.
Did you get six different shows turning up all at once? Yeah. We want one of those, yeah.
So the couple questions I have is, let's say that, you know, we decide, yes, let's do this for this upcoming show. How much do I need to pay one of you, and how long do I need to give you? And also, I got the sense that you don't want to do it for a new show that no one's ever heard, because we're a mass media company.
Oh, well, you...
Where do you get the, like, you know, where do you get those people?
We did a project with Fox Television back 99, 2000 called Freaky Links. And what we did is we took the pilot money and launched a website out of it instead of making the traditional pilot. And so the website was live for 9 months before Fox ever mentioned there was a television show. So once the television show got announced, everyone made an assumption that Fox had literally licensed this poor guy's life and made a television show out of it. And then slowly they began to realize that those two stories were directly interconnected. But that was a nine-month, you know, pre-launch.
But how many people is everyone? Because Freaky Links got canceled really fast once it went on TV,
That's
right?
That's true. That was my favorite thing, was seeing it in the Family Guy shows that had to be canceled before Family Guy would be brought back.
It's a small community right now, but I'm dealing with a mass.
Conversely, at its day, when it launched, it was the fourth highest traffic television show website, and Oprah was going to be next if they hadn't canceled us. But that's what you had is, you know, where compared to like a network's traffic, it wasn't as high. But we were 600,000 plus users a month.
No, that's good.
So, in a very
and you were able to how did you go out there to get those people? How did they find out about it?
It helps when you're writing about monsters and the paranormal, and you sort of draw that audience to you sort of naturally. And having episodic content, having him researching something every week, gave a reason for people to come back and evangelize it. Okay, but there was really very, very little media spend.
So how long did it take you? How long ahead did they come to you, and how much did it cost?
A year. But in that case, we were working with the people who are also creating the television show, which was Haxan that made the Blair Witch Project, and David Goyer, who wrote Blade and Dark City. And so Fox knew they wanted a horror property, and they wanted something with an interactive edge to it.
Would you say it would be really difficult to set something up in a shorter period of time, say 3 to 6 months? Because television folks often turn up and go, hey, our show's on in September.
I have a specific example of last summer with Xenophile's project called The Ocular Effect, which had a turnaround time, I believe, of 2 months order to hit
that
launch
works.
Date.
So the show was ready, you had a transmission date, and you had to create...
Yes, and here's the caveat is that I wanted to say is that I think all of my collaborators would say and agree that you really know that a project is going to be successful by the earliest integration that happens with by how early you're integrated into the creative team.
Yes.
You really need the buy-in from
so
the,
we need
from
so
the
at the development stage we need to say this is a good candidate and then
the
idea
the best.
Yes, completely.
Otherwise you're gonna see the kind of thing that
you're just using scraps.
Right.
Let's use an example. Like, you know, in Fox we could only use the principal stars. We couldn't use guest stars because of SAG rules. Mm-hmm. So whoever the guest star was in those episodes wasn't a choice for us to build an integrated story with. So the sooner you can kind of get ahead of that, the more you can kind of make sure that the television stories don't lock you out of the potential of doing anything.
There's also a good example here in the way that things can possibly go wrong. And you can get it by going right back to the beginning, to 2001 with The Beast. So that was a separate storyline from the film. It was set in the same game world. But the film was AI by Steven Spielberg. Yeah. So the interesting thing there was that they had pretty much, or the creative team for the ARG had a pretty much free rein in their part of the universe, and they created something that was really very good. and then the reviews for the movie came out. And then, because this was one of the one of the first really big ARGs. And, you know, the buzz that the ARG was getting was enormous. I mean, I was on Newsnight, it was in New York Times and everything, and people were saying, you know, this game, it's amazing. This is the future of entertainment. Mm. This is brilliant. And I've seen the movie now. And, well, I think I preferred the game. So you really need at the earliest possible stage, you need everyone to get on the same page. Otherwise, there's going to be this really bizarre mismatch between the two.
And that's the way it always is. Okay, so the final question, though, that no one's answered is, soup to nuts, what's it cost me?
What's it cost to make a TV show?
Yeah, that it is.
It's on those lines.
Yeah. Well, you design the story around the budget.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So if you know you've got a lot of budget, you do car chases and gunplay. And if you know you have a little budget, you hide notes in library books around the country. Yeah. Or call payphones.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Which works.
Just to give a bit of an idea, what would you say the most expensive ARG? How much is the maximum anyone's spent, do you think? Because the minimum is free, right? Or right. 10,000. Yeah.
Historically, I think you measure in millions. Yes. Yeah. That's all that I know.
But you would measure in one handful of millions, not two handfuls.
Okay, we've got 4 minutes, okay, so let's see if we can fit the last two questions in the 4 minutes.
Hi, guys. How do you see measure, or is there any form of like peer-to-peer organic growth with these games? Like, are people going to their neighbors and saying, hey, you got to get involved with this?
That's pretty much how they
Not just that, you give them a task and they'll find someone. So like, oh, we've got a voicemail in Russian. I've got a friend in Moscow. I'll call him right now. So they're literally recruiting in the skills that they need.
They're bringing other people who are previously non-participants into the game.
Correct.
There's a core group of players at Unfiction, which seems to get tagged quite a bit. Like when I Love Bees was launched.
URL for that, Brooke. Unfiction?
Yeah, unfiction.com.
Unfiction.
And the forums are forums.unfiction.com, I think. But they were sent a little jar of honey. So we were given, Unfiction was given a week's advance before the I Love Bees URL went on movie trailers. So we were able to, you know, sort of gather and build and then let this community come in. Other times, you know, it's tagged and it sort of spreads from there, but it allows that sort of first chunk of people, because you need a group mind, and it gives that first group mind before it goes out.
But recruiting more players is definitely one of the sub-games that the players play.
It's kind of got two of the viral fronts, so it's got the kind of, this is really cool, I want to show all my friends, but also I have no idea how to decipher hieroglyphics, so I'm going to have to get in touch with everyone I know, because, again, the story's pulling you along, and you're going to have to work out how to decipher these hieroglyphics, so you ask everyone you know, and they ask all their friends, and they ask all their friends, and then we all get rich.
The only thing I'll add to that is also the real-time quality of it, that you feel as if, you know, I need to get people on board, because this is happening at this moment. Yeah.
And so presumably you build in mechanics into the games that makes this really easy to go and pull people in, right?
And do you track
it better as an industry?
Are you tracking and measuring that, like how that spreads? What are you doing to track that?
Technorati?
Yeah, that's a long conversation. Come up and talk to me later. Yeah. Maybe we're trying to measure
it
a bunch of different ways.
So PR, magic.
Magic.
Let's get this last question. We've got one more minute. Thank you.
Just a quick question. A lot of the games seem to be sort of marketing vehicles for a brand or a product or whatever. I was just wondering about building the game to suit that. Like, obviously, with The Beast, there's a lush story world that you can explore with the game. But other things like, say, I Love Bees, where it's month-long unfolding story for a first-person shooter, how do you kind of decide on how the game is going to take its form?
Well, just before the real answer comes out, I'd just like to challenge that a little bit, which is that I do think there are quite a few examples of things that are not marketing ventures, and I'd like to include some of my own work in that, which is that it's more about creative entertainment that's being put into different windows.
Branded entertainment is the category.
And so there's actually,
it's like the soap operas, when soap operas first started coming out on radio.
They were selling soap operas.
But even without a brand, like for instance, Regenesis, a series that we worked with, that was not associated with anything but the creative elements of the show. And so whether or not that's considered a promotion for the show,
sure,
I think
it's the same.
Yeah.
It's a brand.
Yeah. Well, you wanted to get viewers to turn in. Audi wanted to sell cars.
But
GM wanted
Evan's
people
point
to know
is,
they were great.
Evan's point is maybe that the game was another shard of the same story. It wasn't there just to promote the TV show. It was part of the story in itself, right? So
right.
Yeah.
I think right. So that's a good point. So with Halo 2, Bungie knew what they were doing with Halo 2, and then someone came along and said, "Right, we want to market the launch of Halo 2. How can we do that? Right. Well, we can do an ARG, and then we will write a story that fits with the ARG that will also fit with Halo 2's universe." So there's there's a difference there between stories like with Isle of Bees and like with the Beast, where they're kind of retrofitted onto an existing creative universe. Mm-hmm. And ARGs where they're new or they're part of the same experience. So you get stuff like, and this will happen when creatives are much more aware of the potential. So you'll get it with, you're starting to see it with NBC's Heroes 360. You get it to an extent with The Lost Experience. You get it with Regenesis. Mm. So that's just another facet of how this branding can work.
And on that, to take it back to the marketing thing, do you think that the actual players of these games are like the direct target for a marketing program? Or do you think it's more
broader than that?
Just creating buzz, getting the name?
It's kind of like, to use an analogy with like American Idol, there's a difference between the people who go and audition to be on American Idol and the people who call with their cell phone to vote for their favorite person and the people who just know it exists.
Cool. Yeah.
Right, who are aware of the brand but aren't even a watcher of the television.
With every new ARG, the whole communal audience gets bigger.
But the marketing value is really to all of those groups, not just any one of those segments.
Cool, thank you.
Right, we're out of time. Thank you very much.